Hey guys, welcome back to the show. Boy, I need to start drinking coffee before I check my email in the morning. Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. ScottHorton.org is where I keep all the interview archives. More than 3,500, sorry for saying so many damn times this morning. More than 3,500 interviews now, going back to 2003, there at ScottHorton.org. Mostly on foreign policy, at least since 2007, and plenty of foreign policy ones before that, too. It was a little broader at the beginning there, first couple of years, but anyway, 3,500. There are those, even in these more recent years, who have taken on the project of going back and listening to all of them. I get emails like this from time to time. Man, I love your show. I'm at 2009 and a half now, and I'm almost done. Not even close, but some people really like this show. All right, but for the rest of you, you can hear some things. If you want, it's all for free. MP3 archives for you there at scotthorton.org/interviews. Also, check out scotthorton.org/chat. That's where you guys can hang out in the chat room during the show. They've got the usual suspects in there this morning. Hey, guys. Glad to see you showing up. scotthorton.org/chat. It's an IRC free node chat. If you do IRC free node chats, it's hashtag Scott Horton Show. But you can also just use a plain old browser window and go to scotthorton.org/chat in your Internet Explorer, Mozilla, or Chrome, or Safari, or Opera, or whatever the crap you use there. scotthorton.org/chat. Fill in a fake name and a CAPTCHA, and you're in. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. At Scott Horton Show on Twitter. Okay, so today's show will feature at least one interview. I'm working on a couple of more here. Uh-oh, I better fix that. Today's guest, at least our one guest, will be Matthew Alexander. His real name is Tony Camerino. Tony Camerino. Now, he's been a guest on the show before, although it's been a little while. It's been, I think, maybe many years. I don't know. Let's see, what time, when did he come on? It's been 2007 or 2008, something like that. I didn't even know his real name, or if I did, I had forgotten it. He was going by the pseudonym Matthew Alexander. And he wrote an article for the Washington Post. He ended up following up with two books. But first of all, he wrote a piece for the Washington Post that I interviewed him about, and it was about his time as an interrogator in Iraq hunting down Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and what he learned about the Sunni-based insurgency, and particularly about the foreign fighters joining up and fighting under the banner of Zarqawi in al-Qaeda in Iraq back then. And just for a little bit of context about what's currently going on, obviously with the situation in France, I think it's important to try to broaden this discussion from what the mainstream would have us believe. Oh, they hate us for our freedom. Oh yeah, history began the day before yesterday. And by the way, anybody who insists that history didn't begin the day before yesterday, but actually already existed before that, and that maybe there's something you need to know about it, well, they're all just pro-terrorists, and they're all just defending those who would murder innocents. Same old kind of crap. People think in such black and white terms. Here's my thing about it. I'm an atheist. I'm a libertarian. I have total contempt for religion, personally, and I have absolutely no contempt whatsoever for any person who has religion or believes in their religion, because I'm totally in favor of that. Believe in whatever you want, because I believe in liberty. And so even though I'm not religious, I don't have a chip on my shoulder about it, because my enemy is power. You know, real power in the real world that really hurts people. And so I don't really see it as, I do see it as brave to take down religious sacred cows, etc., like that, all things being equal. I don't think it's brave to pile on with the empire that slaughters people day in, day out, who virtually all happen to be of the faith that you're mocking. In that case, I'm not saying they didn't have the right to do it. I'm not saying the government of France should have outlawed it or whatever like that. But I'm saying that makes the victims in France victims, not heroes. And it's not heroic to just sit around trashing the weak all day. And, you know, for all the people who are celebrating it, they're celebrating and saying, oh, look how brave I am. I'll retweet a picture of a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad, whatever. But what about the ones where they depict a black woman as an animal on a leash with a bone through her nose? Is that brave to put that on the cover of a magazine? Oh, it's so brave to pick on black people. Really? Anyway, the one time one of them picked on a Jew, he was kicked out of the magazine and then prosecuted for anti-Semitism. That's how much they celebrate free speech in France. So, equal opportunity offender, yeah, not so much. Now, I left out of my many, maybe seeming to you contradictory type things, that I'm a free speech zealot. I'm an individualist. I can only be a free speech zealot. On your own property, or property where you are an invited guest, or on the commons, or in the press out there, you have the right to say whatever you want. And to me, yes, that includes obscenity, and that includes insulting the weak, picking on the weak, piling on with power against the powerless. Yeah, free speech to me is, you know, ought to be unlimited. But it doesn't mean that I love you just because, take for example, and this ought to come to anyone's mind, right? It's Raimondo's example from his article on antiwar.com today, too, which is, well, what about if we're talking about just a bunch of American Nazis and all they did was put out pamphlets all day picking on blacks and picking on Jews, and then something terrible happened to them? We all have to go retweeting their cartoons mocking blacks and Jews and calling them animals or whatever kind of thing. That doesn't mean that we have to support the government outlawing Nazis putting out propaganda like that. Of course, they have no authority to do so, and they should not anyway. Nazis have the right to print pamphlets and whatever they want. But that doesn't mean that we have to cry over them if somebody punches them in the mouth. And now these guys, the Charlie Hebdo guys, or however you say it, Hebdo or whatever, they weren't Nazis, but they did sit around picking on the weak all the time. To me, they're a bunch of Bill Maher's. You know, Bill Maher, the extremely rich secular Jew who just hates religion, all religion, except he only ever mentions Islam. How brave. Tell us, please go on at length, sir, about how ridiculous Judaism and Christianity are too. And even then, doesn't that just remind you of being 14? I don't know. I just think it's so childish. And, you know, I don't know. Again, it's hard to argue all things being equal because this is the era of the phony wars. This is the era of the American empire unleashed, soaked in blood, soaked in Muslim blood. So it's not a question of a normal country in a normal time with just regular people criticizing religion, you know? It's not. It's piling on with the murderers. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you. All right, I'm Scott. Welcome back. And listen, at a time like this, people take everything wrong because they want to. Confirmation biases and all. So let me be really clear, okay? I'm not in favor of anybody killing anybody at all, and I'm not even saying anything that even sounds remotely like that. All I'm doing is I'm trying to criticize the reaction to this attack. That's what's really got on my nerves, is the way that... Oh, and it's simple, right? If they had attacked the plumbing college, then it would be the war on plumbers and blah, it's too simple to escape. In this case, they attack journalists, cartoonists, but still, people who write for a living, who use pens and computers for a living. And so, immediately, all of journalism in the West goes, oh, we're under attack. It's Islam, intolerant Islam versus free speech, free expression, free press. But come on, that's looking at war through a soda straw, as Robert Gates would say when he's, you know, doing his special pleading about the collateral murder video. You know, where the Americans were flying a helicopter and massacring a bunch of Reuters reporters. Remember that? Massacring journalists. Oh, you're looking at the war through a soda straw, he said. Yeah, well, there's a war on, guys. You know that. There's a war on. And so, now I know you're used to hearing conservatives say that as though that justifies any horrible thing that happens during the war. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying there's a war on, and that's the context of what happened here. They didn't just get up one morning and decide that their holy book says they should kill anybody who draws a cartoon of the prophet. This is a target in a battle in a war, a tactic within a strategy inside a conflict. And so, you know, I know that when you're an idiot, it's very easy to just project your idiocy onto whoever you're examining too. Oh, well, these cartoonist attackers must be idiots like me. They hate a thing and so they attack it. That must be all of what's at play here, without, you know, thinking it through. They're trying to accomplish something with an attack like this, possibly beyond, I'll show you. And Juan Cole has it right. I got to give him credit. Well, I think he has it right. It's probably too soon to say. But he says, look, this is just like the communist terrorists used to do. This is about sharpening the contradictions. The action is in the reaction. Why did Abu Musab al-Zarqawi suicide bomb marketplaces full of Shia women and children? Because he wanted the Shiite death squads to fight back and murder Sunni women and children. To sharpen the contradictions. To rally more Sunnis to his cause. The action is in the reaction. Will Grigg, student of communist terrorism, before the modern war on terrorism, taught me that in, I think, his first or second article after September 11th. They're trying to get us to overreact. They're trying to get us to do a thing. So that means the burden is on us double to be prudent and thoughtful and smart about how we respond and don't play into our enemy's hands. The action is in the reaction. What are they trying to do? As Juan Cole puts it, the Muslims of France are almost Muslim in name only. They're Muslim by heritage. They're French. And maybe they're not completely integrated into society, but they are French. And they are, as Raimondo points out in his column today on antiwar.com, second and third generation Frenchmen. And they're just not interested in fundamentalist religion. And they're just not interested in fighting any kind of jihad on behalf of bin Ladenites anywhere. There are more than 5 million Muslims in France and they're just not Bin Ladenites. Well, so how do you turn them into Bin Ladenites if you're trying to? Blow up stuff. Kill people. Provoke a crackdown on French Muslims. Increase their alienation. And then hopefully generate more people to your cause. It's the same thing with attacks on the United States. Trying to provoke what Bin Laden called that choking life. So we will create a police state for ourselves so that Americans will become so alienated from our government that we turn against its policy. So that Muslims in America will be so alienated by the crackdown that they turn around and become Alaki and go and join up the other side. Maybe even commit attacks here. And that's only going on sketchy information. We don't exactly know what's going on here. And when they say that these guys or one of these guys went to Yemen and came back, I don't know. They may be lying. It seems to me confirmation bias, because I've been predicting this and warning about this for years, that the most likely answer is here that one or both of these guys went to Syria and they were recruited to go back and do an attack in France, in order to provoke that overreaction that they're trying to provoke. And it's just the simplest explanation. From everything they're saying, and I don't know if any of this is true yet or what, but from everything they're saying, they've known who these guys are since one of them, the older brother, I think, tried to travel to Iraq to fight under Zarqawi back in 2005. And he was prosecuted for it. And they've known who he is and who his brother is all this time. And now they're saying one of them went to Yemen, maybe the other went to Syria. I don't know. But I do know that French special forces and spies have been helping to orchestrate the jihad against Assad, has been organizing the jihadist side of the Syrian civil war since 2011. I know that because high-level French military and intelligence officials told that to Eric Margolies, and I know Eric Margolies. And they've been part of this whole NATO, Saudi, Turkey, well, Turkey's part of NATO, Qatari, Saudi, NATO plot to regime change Bashar al-Assad in Syria. So you have blowback from the Iraq war, and you got backdraft from Syria. If it's true that this guy went to Yemen, then I guess you got some more backdraft there. But honestly, it just doesn't ring true to me. I don't know. It seems kind of like they're lying. I'm not sure why, though. Just kind of my gut tells me. One thing about that is, though, is that one of the people that they told that to is our friend Nancy Youssef, who I have a lot of respect for. She's a great reporter, and I'm going to try to see if I can get her on the show Monday and ask her more about her sources that tell her that they're certain that this guy had been to Yemen. But assuming that the official story is true about who these guys are and what motivated them, it's a direct consequence of American and French foreign policy in Iraq and in Syria. And it's also proof of what I've been telling you at least for a year straight, which is, hey, man, what about all these Western Europeans and Americans who have gone to Syria to fight, who can come back and do lone wolf attacks, as they're called, in Western Europe or even in America? And do you trust the national police and intelligence agencies of America and its Western European allies to keep these guys out once they've left? I don't. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back. Well, I tried to get Will again, but I can only take up so much of that guy's time. I just got my gas bill. Doesn't seem much lower to me. I don't know. Will can't do it. You know why? Because he's got to do his own show. What, like I should get a monopoly on all of Will Griggs' time? That would be fair. It's just that I figure that That guy's wise, man. I like listening to him say stuff. I wanted to hear him talk about France and terrorism and free speech and the rest of these things, because he's nuanced in ways that I'm just not. I try to be, but meh. So anyway, Tony Camerino is coming up on the show. I'm going to try to ask him about his experience during the Iraq War and see what we can learn about all that. In the chat room, was it Mirko? M. Strong says, hey, I agree with what you're saying about piling on, you know, these cartoonists being, you know, not standing up to the powerful, but standing up to the weak and all that. He says, as an individualist, I'm still going to mock head choppers, chopper offers all day long. Yeah, no, and you should, too. I mean, these guys are the scum of the earth. Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State and their sympathizers, you know. Unfortunately, these guys can't be tried and prosecuted and then sentenced to death because they're already dead, apparently, from the attack this morning. But, yeah, no, they're crazy kooks. No question about that. Or not really crazy kooks, but they're sons of bitches. They're evil murderers of noncombatants, which makes them as bad as Republicans and Democrats who sit around murdering innocent people every single day. Don't ever forget. Every single day, this government is killing people, innocent people. And so for these two Al-Qaeda guys to, you know, run around like Barack Obama with machine guns, slaughtering people is absolutely unconscionable. And, you know, nothing anybody says to explain why there's more to this than just Islam versus free speech should ever be interpreted as any kind of apologia or rationalization or excuse-making for this, just explaining the reason behind it. I'd be happy to pull the trapdoor out from under their gallows myself. You know? They're absolute scum. And look at the Islamic State guys, who are no different than al-Nusra. I mean, these guys are all the descendants of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And they crucify people to death. They murder children. And you know what? Being an American and bombing a house full of kids, that's absolutely horrible in the very same way as far as the effect on the victims goes. But compare that to actually just deliberately murdering a kid at point-blank range, which American soldiers do sometimes, like Robert Bales and things like that. But for the Islamic State, that's just how they do business. Murdering and enslaving women, murdering children, They're the scum of the earth. And when the Bada Brigade kills them, I don't mind. When they kill the Bada Brigade, I don't mind that either, because the Bada Brigade are just as bad as them. Yeah, no, these guys are absolutely horrible, man. They're Osama bin Ladenites. They're butchers of innocence. And the fact that I don't like the French Bill Maher's that all got killed doesn't mean that I think that they shouldn't have all lived to die in their 80s of natural causes. There's all kinds of people that I can't stand. Doesn't mean I want them to die. The Islamic State guys, I don't even mind if they die. Screw them, man. I just don't want the Americans doing it because I think, it's America's fault anyway, and all America can do is make more of them and whatever. But, you know, if the American Empire went away and whatever combination of Middle Eastern armies went and killed the Islamic State, I don't mind that. I certainly oppose the death of a single innocent civilian, and the Americans have been killing innocent civilians in their wars, the new wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria in the last... 6 months here. But anyway, yeah, I want to make sure I get that out of the way or off my chest or whatever, that it should go without saying. But it doesn't go without saying. I know how people are. And you know what? People still, look, I can think of other examples where somebody got killed for mocking the prophet. Yeah, but still, before or after the terror war, before or after the invasion of Iraq, before or after the war in Libya and the war in Mali and the war in Syria, You know, if we were talking about all things being equal, here we are, white, post-Christian, Western civilization, minding our own business, engaging in commerce and art, and these damned Muslim barbarians at the gates just won't leave us alone. Well, that would be an entirely different universe than the one we live in, where, in fact, it's the West, the American government, and its sock puppets in Europe primarily, who are the aggressors. Who are the aggressors. And that doesn't justify what those fighting back does, but it makes an entirely different story than the one you're being fed. And, you know, September 11th is the easier one, probably, because that one was really blowback in the sense that the activity that caused it was way under Americans' radar. The support for Israel and their crimes in the Middle East, the occupation of Saudi Arabia and the war against Iraq. I mean, it's not like those things were secret, but they were just never mentioned at all. You know, there's a Simpsons where Bart goes to the military academy and his commanding officer says, "Well, that was really good, but that's more cursing than I like to hear from a cadet in peacetime." But it was 1996 or something, and Bill Clinton was murdering thousands of people all day, every day in Iraq from bases in Saudi Arabia. But that counted for peacetime. As people thought of it as peacetime. And then you look at the footage on TV, and here come these airplanes out of the clear blue sky, literally. It makes for the perfect lie, for the perfect backdrop, for a false metaphor about what happened, where an extremist belief in Islam motivated these madmen to attack all that is good and true and beautiful and innocent, when that's just not what happened. They were, one, seeking revenge for Bill Clinton's mass murders, but two, they were engaging in a tactical strike, or maybe a strategic strike on America in order to provoke an overreaction. And that's so well documented from 100 ways, but it didn't get explained to the American people. The French, they're a little bit more savvy than Americans, and they're a little bit more connected to current events probably as well. So it's kind of, you know, pretty hard. They're the ones who warned us not to invade Iraq, and this was one of the reasons why. Back under Jacques Chirac, if you go back and look, back when Americans were saying, "First Iraq, then France. How dare our allies since the days of the American Revolution oppose a war we want to start? We should start one with them next," cried the Texans. They were warning us that this was going to be the consequences of getting rid of secular, chin-whiskerless Saddam Hussein back in 2003. And I forgot what I was going to say. What was I going to say? So, if this was simply a matter of regular people, regular decent people engaging in art and being oppressed or attempted oppressed by religious zealots in a vacuum, then that would be a much simpler explanation, and which with much simpler dividing lines. You know, I don't know. I hope people can understand what I'm trying to get there and not take it all wrong, like it's some kind of excuse. But the self-pity being engaged in by virtually, I don't know, every journalist in my Twitter feed, like this was an attack on them and an attack on their freedom, an attack on their right to write things and draw things, is just so far off base. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. So, Gregory D. Johnson, who is a real expert on Yemen, and I guess is reporting from there right now, he's at BuzzFeed News, It's interesting that he writes for BuzzFeed, but I guess money, you know. Anyway, no contact with Paris about Charlie Hebdo attack, says Yemeni official. You know, they're starting to say that maybe one of these guys was actually in contact with Anwar al-Awlaki. Really? Yeah, I don't know, man, how convenient all these narratives are. On the other hand, I don't know. My best guess still is that it's the Syrian connection to Jabhat al-Nusra, or maybe more internationalist bent al-Qaeda types in Syria who do exist and do have their own motives for doing things like this, obviously. But maybe that's just because that's exactly specifically what I've been warning about so much. For the last 3 years. You gotta admit, it's almost unbelievable. But the U.S. has backed the jihadist side of the war in Libya and in Syria. And I'm not saying that ISIS are the sock puppets of the Americans. I think the Americans and their foreign policy and NATO foreign policy created the space for the old remnants of al-Qaeda in Iraq to come back. And they did. And the al-Nusra Front made, you know, headway on the battlefield. They're the Syrian branch of al-Qaeda, and they quickly usurped the entire revolution over there. Because guess what? Moderates aren't the ones doing the fighting. The guys doing the fighting are the ones who don't mind dying. And so that was the al-Nusra Front, and then Baghdadi split from Golani and went ahead and created the Islamic State out of the, you know, basically the more Iraqi-based faction of al-Nusra, of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and created the Islamic State. And I don't think that that was the CIA's plan. Yeah, they make for a great enemy, but then again, all the U.S. government has to do all day is just show up and they create enemies. I wouldn't always give them too much credit for being so smart about how they do it. I certainly don't think that the plan was, oh yeah, and then they'll create a brand new state in western Iraq and eastern Syria that we'll have to have another full-scale war against. You know, I think Obama, when he called ISIS junior varsity a year ago, I think that's what he thought. They said, well, what about the ISIS? And his answer was, well, I don't read Patrick Coburn, so I don't know the first thing about it, and I'm not worried about it, really. And I appreciate part of that, because what he was saying was, right around that time, was, hey, just because a Sunni with a rifle calls himself al-Qaeda doesn't mean he's going to be able to successfully bait America into a war. We fight forever like that. This is where Obama even quoted Madison, saying no nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. In other words, F Boko Haram and the Islamic State and whoever else. They're a bunch of nobodies. They're a bunch of wannabe bin Ladens. But what he didn't realize was, nuh-uh, dude, you've been fighting wars for these guys since 2011, and they have taken the opportunity you provided to grow up into a menace at least as powerful as al-Qaeda ever was, and probably much more so. And so, even though all last spring on this show, I was interviewing Phil and interviewing Michael Scheuer and interviewing Patrick Coburn, especially Patrick Coburn, interviewing Jonathan Lande, interviewing Dar Jamail, interviewing everybody I could about the re-rise of the jihadists. Coburn did that giant five-part series, was published in March. I had Jonathan Lande on this show and Michael Scheuer both on this show, and I was saying, listen, the lawless territory in eastern Syria and western Iraq, the name of their group is the Islamic State. And so how long before it's a real caliphate right there? That's where we're going back to war. Michael Scheuer said, I think we're going to go to war in Nigeria because all that oil and Boko Haram. And I said, no, man, it's going to be Syria and Iraq where we have this massive state bigger than Texas, or at least this is the size of Texas. Completely uncontrolled by the Baghdad government or the Damascus government, and under the sway of the tribes already in alliance with the Islamic State of Iraq. And go back and check the archives. All spring long, poor Eric Garris at antiwar.com, you know, we'd talk on the phone and instant message and whatever all damn day. And that poor guy, I must have told him 100 times, you know, off the air, I'm telling you, man, this Islamic State thing is a big deal, man. Look out, dude. This is about to blow up on you, man. And nope, Obama's going, nah, they're junior varsity. They're nothing. We ain't got to take that serious. And I'm not saying that he should have went in there and killed him. I'm saying he should have went in there and never backed him. And I don't mean directly, because I don't believe America ever directly backed the Islamic State. But they should never have had a policy of training any of the rebels, supporting, financing, arming, supplying any of the rebels. They should have never had a policy of supporting the bogus Friends of Syria governments in exile that they were trying to create in Qatar. And they should have never tolerated for a day the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, the Israelis providing weapons and money to the rebellion in Syria. Sorry, I don't care how much you hate Bashar al-Assad. His enemies are bin Ladenites. And so we, the empire, will not support your attempt to get rid of him. Should have been the American policy from 2011 on. And in fact, they could have pushed for peace talks. They could have. They had Geneva 1 and Geneva 2, both of which said Assad has to agree to leave power before we would insist that anyone that we're backing against him has to negotiate with him. They prolonged this thing and prolonged this thing, and they blew up this war until it became the Islamic State in a whole new war. Until Sunnistan declared independence from Iraq permanently. Until the entire history of the world was rewritten. And then they went, oops. And now all they can do is make it worse. All they can do now is airstrikes. And they are sending Marines back there. They are sending Army back there slowly. But not too slowly. They've already got Apache helicopters in the fight. They've already got special forces and spies and mercs in the fight. And they've already got blowback. And it's just so obvious, man. And I've been, go back and check the damn archives if you're new and you don't believe me and you think I'm bragging or some kind of thing. I don't have a production staff to go back and like find all the clips for me or all that. But I've been warning that you're going to see veterans, European veterans, of the Syrian war coming back to Europe in order to provoke those states into going back to war over there, in order to provoke them to invade. Same old story, to bleed the empire to bankruptcy until we're finally done. And just because America and France took the side of the jihadists in Libya and in Syria doesn't mean that, oh, well, they should love us now. That's what Bill Clinton thought too. Hey, look, we'll fight on the side of the Muslims in the Balkans. And then that'll win us a huge PR victory, and they'll never want to attack us again. Oh, yeah, they totally don't mind the occupation of Saudi Arabia, the occupation of Palestine, the permanent bombing and blockade of Iraq. They don't mind any of that as long as you help support them in Bosnia, Bill. Tell that to the 3,000 dead on September 11th. And they're trying to pull that same scam now. Well, yeah, Libya was in France was involved in the Libya war, but they were on the side of Ansar al-Sharia in that one, so what's the problem? Well, maybe they still hate you anyway. And of course, France is involved in the new war in the Islamic State right now. They were involved in the war in Mali, fighting against the jihadists there. And anyway. Evan in the chat room says, I'm still glad McCain isn't president. I'm with you there. You know what? If McCain was president, we wouldn't be having this conversation at all. Because if McCain was president, we would have all died in a nuclear war with Russia in 2009. I absolutely believe that. And usually I know there ain't a dime's worth of difference between this party or that one. There ain't a dime's worth of difference between philosophies, if you can call them that, the belief systems of liberalism and conservatism in modern America. But, and there ain't a dime's worth of difference between Obama and Romney. But John McCain, yeah, he's a particular kind of sicko, madman. Never good enough for his father and grandfather, kind of a weirdo. And who was tortured after all. He's a madman like Zarqawi or Zawahiri after they were tortured and became terrorists, too. An irrational man. So, yeah, at least there's that. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Full interview archives at scotthorton.org. More than 3,500 of them now, going back to 2003. Sign up for the podcast feeds there and all that if you want. Interviews only or the whole show archives. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. All right, our guest today is Tony Camerino. You might know him as Matthew Alexander, who wrote the book Kill or Capture. And also, How to Break, I think this was the first one, How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. interrogator who used brains, not brutality, to take down the deadliest man in Iraq. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Tony?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing real good. I don't know if you even remember. We spoke once about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago or whenever you originally wrote that article for the Washington Post, I believe it was. And I regret that I have not read your books. Although, certainly they should be on the pile of books that I need to read. No doubt about that. But appreciate you joining us on the show. And the reason why I have you on is because you've come up in conversation over the last few days about the motivation for terrorist attacks. And, of course, the narrative about the French attack is that, for example, George Packer in The New Yorker wrote a piece. And the answer is that, you know, all you need to know is Salman Rushdie. The truth is, Islam is just intolerant of free speech, and so this was an attack by Islam against free speech, and that's just about it. And yet, there's a personal history of the now-dead terrorist attackers that's being told by the French police, which, you know, seem to indicate that perhaps they had earthly political reasons for some of the things they did, including apparently there was a documentary that profiled the older brother who was an aspiring rapper and who was clearly not a religious, pious type at all back when he was trying to go and fight in Iraq 10 years ago. And so I was just wondering, you know, what's your initial impression of what's going on here? And do you have any insight you think that we could learn about, you know, what this attack on this French magazine means in the context of the broader war on terrorism?
Well, it's interesting, but not surprising. I mean, these type of attacks, I think, are going to continue, and we're going to see more of them, I believe. And it's not surprising. I mean, we are technically at war. You know, we do have combat troops in both Iraq and in Afghanistan. And in all countries that are participating in those conflicts, I think, or are in any way supporting them, can expect that there are going to be, you know, retaliatory attacks. And the question of what motivates these two individuals, it's hard to speculate at this point. What I can tell you just from my experience having interrogated in Iraq is that individuals who decide to join extremist groups do it for a variety of reasons. But most of those, the majority of those reasons aren't religious. The majority of those reasons typically come down to socioeconomic reasons. And so you see that a lot of the recruits that make it into these extremist organizations are people that were disenfranchised by their societies, by the culture in which they lived in, and for either economic reasons or social reasons decided to go and join this. You know, some of these violent groups.
Right. Now, yeah, I guess I kind of screwed up on your introduction there. I meant to explain for people who don't remember that you were an interrogator in the Iraq War. It says here in your bio you supervised over 1,300 interrogations in Iraq. And the reason that you came public in the first place was to try to explain that in your experience, basically treating captives well was a much better way to get quality information out of them than brutalizing them. And I believe the story goes that's how you found the gained the intelligence that led to the targeting, the successful targeting and killing of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the founder of al-Qaeda in Iraq. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, my primary approach was to get to know people. That was kind of my bread and butter, get to know people, understand what motivates them, why they joined al-Qaeda in the first place. And then once you knew that, then you could decide on a technique, an interrogation technique, a non-coercive technique that would in some way apply an incentive that would convince them to cooperate with you and to abandon al-Qaeda. And that incentive, you know, in 90% of the cases was intangible. It was either reaffirmation of some grievance they felt, or sometimes just straight compassion and understanding for why they had decided to join al-Qaeda. But that was my approach. And what I found is that a lot of interrogators were making the mistake of assuming that everybody who had joined al-Qaeda had done so for religious reasons, that it was because they hated our culture or because they believed in Osama bin Laden's very radical beliefs, and that's why they had joined al-Qaeda. But that was always just a facade. You know, there are a few cases where there are hardcore religious or believers in very hardcore religious beliefs that who had joined for religious reasons. But even those guys, I believe, if you really dig back, even, for instance, Zarqawi, if you go back to his history, you'll find that it's not actually rooted in religion. It was rooted in criminality and social injustice as he saw it.
Mm-hmm. A very important point on him in particular. Sorry to interrupt, but yeah, he was just a two-bit rapist. Zarqawi was, until he was tortured by America's king in Jordan. And that was when he decided to grow up and get serious about life and decided he wanted to go to Afghanistan and see if he could get into some real trouble.
Yeah, and let's not forget, you know, a lot of times when we look at some of these acts that are committed by members of al-Qaeda, the more gruesome ones, every organization has criminals in it, right? I mean, some of the members of al-Qaeda certainly are some of them are truly psychopathic criminals and commit very heinous acts. But, you know, we have that in the U.S. military, too. And not to say that we're the same, but we do have criminals in the military who commit heinous acts. And we've seen that in Afghanistan, Iraq, and al-Qaeda does, too. But it'd be a mistake to say that everyone who commits these heinous acts in al-Qaeda represents the strong ideological religious arm of that organization.
Right.
So, for instance, in Iraq, the large majority of members of al-Qaeda were Sunnis who were moderate religiously but had joined al-Qaeda for weapons and money. And now, with a group like ISIS, I believe you have a very large and stronger faction at the top of religious radicals, mm-hmm. but those religious and radical beliefs were formed in American prisons in Iraq
now,
because of torture.
When you're talking about the al-Qaeda in Iraq, circa, what are we talking, 05, 06 here, basically?
Well, you're talking the beginning or when I was there?
Yeah, I mean, in your experience.
I was there in 06.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so now, you got 1,300 interrogations done just in the first half or just in that 1 year? That's a lot.
In 5 months, yeah.
So now, when we talk about AQI, how exactly do you define it? Because sometimes that meant any foreigner who traveled to Iraq to fight. Sometimes it meant the entire Sunni-based insurgency. Sometimes it meant just those who actually are working for Zarqawi and that kind of thing. And I wonder how specific you are about that. And I wonder whether you notice when the Libyans, the Syrians, the Saudis, and whoever, whatever other foreign fighters came to fight, were they any more religious or they were just as motivated by secular politics? You know, earthly reasons, I mean to say, not so much secular, but you know what I mean, earthly reasons as the Iraqis who were fighting with them?
You know, it really depends. It really depends on the person's background. In Iraq, there was, you know, I think at one point over 20 separate insurgent groups. You know, you had I can't even start, the 1920s Brigade. You had so many different groups that were operating there. But many of those groups were actually associated and or formed really within the tribal structure. So if a certain tribe said, okay, we're not going to join the government because of de-pacification or because of the disbanding the army or because of the Shia militias and we're going to defend ourselves, we're going to join our group and we're going to give it a name.
I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you. We got to take this break. It's Tony Camerino, a.k.a. Matthew Alexander, Iraq War Interrogator. Be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Tony Camerino, a.k.a. Matthew Alexander. He is a fellow at the Burkle Center at UCLA. Go Bruins! And he's the author of How to Break a Terrorist and Kill or Capture, about his time in Iraq as an interrogator there. And now, so I want to get back to, well, I'm sorry, you were interrupted in the middle of what you were saying. You remember where you were?
Yeah, I was talking about the various insurgent groups that had grown up in Iraq.
Right, right.
After our invasion, and that many of them were aligned with tribes. But when you look at Al-Qaeda in Iraq, really the majority of it was groups that had decided through the Sunni tribes to join Al-Qaeda, really because it was a marriage of convenience. The Sunni tribes needed weapons and money to defend themselves from the Shia militias that were being allowed to run free by the central government, in some ways sponsored by the central government, and Al-Qaeda provided that. And you also saw that, you know, when Petraeus came in and paid the tribes and gave them weapons, how quickly they disbanded from Al-Qaeda. It pretty much tells you that the majority of them had no religious affiliations with Al-Qaeda. They really had joined for practical reasons.
Yeah. And now, so when you talk about you said at the beginning, it seemed like the primary underwriting motivation here was socioeconomic problems by the volunteers.
Yeah, if you look at Iraq in particular, the majority of oil in Iraq is in Shia land. It's along the border with Iran in the south east.
There's some up in Kurdistan.
There's some up in Kurdistan. And there's some processing that happens in Baji and in places in Sunni territory, but for the most part, there's very little oil in Sunni Iraq. And so, you know, under Saddam, they were guaranteed some of the oil revenue, right, that would be distributed to them through the central government. But now with a Shia-led government and in a democracy that's there now, there is no guarantee that they'll get any of that revenue. And that is really, truly what the conflict in Iraq comes down to, is those Sunni tribes in the north and west have to be able to feed their families. And there is very little industry outside of oil for them to be able to do that. And as long as the central government is not going to share that oil revenue with them, they are going to turn to groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda that will allow them to try to take that revenue by force.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that ship's already sailed by now, but that'd be a whole different direction for the conversation. I want to get back to what you had said previously about, I guess, primarily in reference to the foreign fighters who had come to join and fight under Zarqawi or otherwise for the Sunni-based insurgency back then, that it was, according to them, in your interrogations, it was the pictures of the torture from Abu Ghraib and the pictures of the guys in the orange jumpsuits being held without trial at Guantanamo Bay that was what really motivated so many of these guys to go ahead and make the trip to Iraq to fight.
Yeah, and let's remember, they didn't need pictures. I mean, the pictures certainly poured flames on everything, but there was, at least within Iraqis and for other foreigners who had been captured by U.S. forces in Iraq in the early days, you know, they experienced the torture and word got out. So because, it wasn't just Abu Ghraib, it wasn't just, you know, one place here or there. Remember, at one point, Donald Rumsfeld had authorized enhanced interrogation techniques, a.k.a. torture and abuse, to be used by all. And even after they rescinded that permission, many units continued to use them because the justification that was given to them was, well, you can use these because it'll save lives. So even after they rescinded, people thought, well, if it's okay to torture, Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld say it's okay to torture to save lives, then, you know, why not? They're saying it's okay. Mm-hmm. So this widespread, and I'm not going to say that, you know, I think the number of interrogators who tortured was less than a majority. I think even many interrogators who were permitted or allowed to use these techniques refused to use them. But there were enough cases that it became well known within Iraq, among the insurgents, among the foreign fighters, among Iraqis that had been captured, that Americans used torture. And they abused prisoners, and that spread very quickly. And the photos from Abu Ghraib and what happened at Guantanamo Bay was just more fuel on the fire, you know?
Yep. Yeah, you know, and I remember incredibly even, you know, anti-war reporters like Aaron Glantz reporting for Democracy Now!, he had no problem saying, hey, I'm here in Tikrit, and these people, I can't lie to you, they're happy that America invaded and got Saddam for them, but they don't trust us, and I'm talking about right after the invasion. They don't trust us, and they're looking at us sideways, and we have a very short window of opportunity to show that we mean what we say about how much we love them. And it seems like that window's already closing here pretty quick, and it wasn't very long before they came to really realize. Well, and I think, you know, as Matthew Ho has said on the show, that even in the highest level discussions of military intelligence, whatever, the debate was still framed as it's the people of Iraq versus the terrorists. And what you say about, well, the Sunni tribes were being cut out of the oil wealth and all this, which, I mean, that kind of analysis was being discussed on my little pirate radio show back then as well, that they wouldn't talk about stuff like that. They really framed it just as the terrorists. So anybody you're torturing is a terrorist, so go ahead and torture them. And they were creating all their own enemies. Brutality from the get-go.
Yeah, I don't think we can say that, you know, America didn't create ISIS. Zarqawi created, you know, al-Qaeda in Iraq, which later became ISIS, but we certainly added the fuel that allowed it to ignite and then prosper later in Syria and move into Iraq by using torture. And you know, my unit in particular, we tracked foreign fighters that we captured and did interviews, you know, and assessed why they had come to fight. And the number one reason they briefed every new interrogator on this, the number one reason they had come to fight was because of torture and abuse at Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo. And
by the way, does that count for any Europeans?
I don't remember us ever capturing any Europeans.
Because, of course, the story that they're saying about the French shooter, the older brother, was that he was arrested trying to go to fight in Iraq in 2005 and told the judge he was motivated by the pictures of the torture and the abuse. And here was a guy who was a rapper and everything but a devout religious fundamentalist who, you know, claimed then that that's what he was motivated by was American policy.
Yeah, well this isn't a surprise, right? Because the 9/11 hijackers had very strong ties to Europe, right? The millennial bomber was French Algerian, had lived in France for a number of years. Richard Reed had passed through France and spent time there. So, you know, there's plenty of seeds of radical Islam in Europe, and many of those are fueled by obviously our foreign policies and some of the awful mistakes we've made in the Middle East. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess I don't really have a very good thumb on the pulse of what things were really like in the Middle East before, but Michael Scheuer, I guess, warned beforehand and has said since that American policy has radicalized a generation where it just didn't have to happen at all.
And, well, 3,000 radicals before 9/11 and probably 50, 60,000 now.
Yeah.
You know, that pretty much tells you what our policy has accomplished.
Yeah, where these guys are basically the nutcase ranting on the street corner that nobody cares about until all of a sudden things are on fire and people are dying and screaming, and he seems prescient because I told you this was going to happen, he says, and he has the explanation for why it happened and everything, which makes them the kind of the perfect mirror image of the war party here. They already have an explanation. It's the Islam makes them do it so much, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you know my perspective is that it's not really about religion. The religion is just the, it's just the excuse. It's really about social conditions and economics.
Yep. All right, well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, you don't, it's, I have yet to, I never met the guy, you know, in Iraq, of all the foreign fighters that we interrogated and all the people we talked to, I never met the guy who was like, you know, woke up one day and was like, jihad, that's the reason I'm going to Iraq to fight. Right. It's never just religion. It's always,
you know,
another reason.
If we can make it a little bit more complicated, did any of them decide that religion, that their religion was so opposed to our way of life, that was what made them go and fight, that we let our daughters wear miniskirts to junior college and to vote in primary elections and these kinds of things and R-rated movies, and this is why we had to pay?
No. I mean, that just never happens, really. I mean, even if you look at Osama bin Laden's three demands prior to 9/11, none of them had to do with really American culture. They were U.S. support to Israel. They were the presence of U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia and U.S. support for monarchies in the Middle East that he considered to be corrupt. That none of those reasons had anything to do with culture. Now, that's not to say he didn't dislike our culture, or that, you know, some of these fundamentalists do resent our culture, and especially, you know, with regards to women's rights. But those aren't the political reasons for why they've turned to violence.
All right, well, thank you so much for your time, and come back on the show, Tony, and I sure hope I have a chance to get to your book sometime soon.
Yeah, give it a try.
I will. Appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
All right, y'all, that's Tony Camerino. He formerly was known as Matthew Alexander, the pseudonymous author of How to Break a Terrorist and Kill or Capture, and he's now a fellow at the Burkle Center at UCLA. We'll be right back in just a sec. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Ha, this is funny from George Washington's blog. If Paris killers had Western media on their side. Freedom fighters' gun strike in Europe is said to have killed 12 militants. And it goes on like that. You know, that could be if it was the exact same guy fighting in Syria, attacking pro-Assad forces. That might be how they would spin it. I have to say, this is still the biggest irony to me of this whole war, is that because of our so-called allies first policy here, whatever Israel wants and whatever Saudi Arabia wants being the most important consideration in all questions, that means that the war against the Islamic State is less worse than it could be. Because how in the hell do you turn an entire regime change against Assad around? It's hard. I was telling you yesterday, there's a piece from 2 days ago by Roy Gutman and McClatchy about how America and Turkey agree that they're going to train up some rebels. They're not sure what they're going to do with them after that, though. But they're working on it. And sorry, I'm getting emails on. While I'm talking, I need to close this thing. Leave me alone. Let's see. Americans training jihadists in Syria. Yeah, so no, they're not jihadists when we train them. They're the Free Syrian Army moderates when we train them. You know, moderates like the Northern Storm Brigade. You know, like the guys that John McCain went and met, except if you just Google Northern Storm Brigade, there's an interview with their leader where he explains that he was a veteran of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. He went and fought for those same guys that Tony Camerino was just describing on the show, the Zarqawi faction there. And And there never were any moderates. The so-called Free Syrian Army, they behead people too. They're Islamists too. They are really just a different name for the same thing. And the only difference, ultimately, between Ahrar al-Sham and the Islamic Front and the al-Nusra Front and the Free Syrian Army and the Islamic State is who's calling the shots. Otherwise, they're all basically the same. And that is, I guess, as he, I think, quite correctly describes, people who are economically completely screwed and have their war all dressed up in religiosity to provide it cohesion and purpose. And there ain't a moderate among them. But Israel and Saudi and Qatar and Turkey, why, they all hate Assad for all kinds of different reasons, not least of which is the Saudi purpose that they want to build a pipeline to Turkey. But they got to go through Syria, and Assad said no from Shiistan, from southern Iraq. And Assad said no. And or no, I guess they're going to go around Shiistan and go from through the Saudi desert, through Sunnistan, and through Syria to Turkey. But now that I think about it, I think I saw a map of that thing. But anyway, so Assad's in the way of that. That's a major part of the Saudi grudge against him, and plus a bunch of, you know, other reasons I don't even know. But so America has been fighting on the side of the Mujahideen, has been backing the Mujahideen in Syria. And because of all the he's a Hitler propaganda against Bashar al-Assad, which, yeah, he's a mean, evil police state murderer son of a bitch. Nobody ever said otherwise, ever, I don't think. But he represents a majority coalition of the country, which includes a lot of Sunnis, too, by the way. It's not a pure sectarian war. There are a lot of Sunnis who do not support the rebellion and instead support the government, which is the only thing standing between them and all the other religious minority groups, and a good beheading at the hands of al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria, the Islamic State, or for that matter, the Free Syrian Army guys, so-called. And they just, it's hard to admit that, yeah, you know what? We sort of have been on the side of the Mujahideen all this time, and now it's blown up in our face, and so now we're just going to go to war against them, and, you know, the easiest way to do that would be to go back to the Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and earlier Barack Obama policy of cooperating with Assad against the Mujahideen. And, boy, pretty hard to turn that policy back around again. I saw Josh Block, the former spokesman for AIPAC. I follow him on Twitter. And or was it Bill Kristol and he retweeted it? I forget. No, it was... Anyway, I saw some, you know, right-wing Zionist on the Twitter earlier saying that, yep, you know, the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and al-Nusra, and the Islamic Republic, and Hezbollah, oh yeah, they're all the same thing, they're all the bad guys. Oh yeah, you totally fooled me with that one. A bunch of bin Ladenites, thrown in there with your Shiite enemy states. Well, pseudo-state in the case of Hezbollah. But Iran is ISIS and al-Nusra's greatest enemy. Doesn't mean they're better people. It just means they're their greatest enemy. And of course, that's Israeli policy since September 11th has been to try to confuse the issue of who all is who, which all so-called or actual terrorist group is allied with who. Who, them? They're all the same. Persians and Arabs, they're all the same thing, too. Shia, Sunni, this, that, the other. Hey, if the Israelis don't like them, they're terrorists trying to kill you, and that's all you need to know. And so, under that sort of ignorance is bliss foreign policy, if you can call it that, they end up just creating hell on earth where they're on both sides of this war still. To this day, ever since 2003... America's been, and George Bush's invasion, America's been fighting on the side of Iran and Iran's sock puppet militias. And ever since 2011, anyway, and really earlier, America has been supporting the Mujahideen against the Iranian-backed Assad government in Syria. And even if you think the Iranians are just as bad somehow or just as fundamentalist religiously and you hate that or whatever it is, somehow, Iran never attacked America. Iran never killed 3,000 Americans. And the Iranians never were the Zarqawiite suicide bombers. Although they were the Bada Brigade torturer murderers. But they were working for the U.S., or was the U.S. working for them, more like, in Iraq at the time. So that made them our SOBs in D.C. terminology. But anyway, the whole thing is a catastrophe, but just look at it the other way around. If it wasn't for Saudi Arabia and Israel, well, I guess there probably wouldn't be an Islamic State because we'd have never been supporting the whole thing in the first place. But if it wasn't for the fact that that our empire has such trouble turning its narrative around from Assad is the worst thing going in Syria to ISIS and Nusra are, it's prevented a worse war, I think. Just, hey, there's a new bin Ladenite state is a much simpler narrative. But the only way really to take them on in Syria is to back Assad, and they can't do that. They can't do that. I'm not saying they should. But I'm just saying, under their premises, they want to fight this war and defeat the Islamic State. That's what they would have to do, and they can't do it. And I think at this point they do want to. I think this is why Hegel was fired, was Hegel said, we got to at least decide what it is we're doing here. Are we backing anyone at all? Are we backing someone or the other one? Or are we still deciding? And Obama just wants to put it off and just wants to keep the thing going on autopilot as is. Let's see how that's working out. Oh, good. Another interview with Brian McGlinchey next. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is Brian McGlinchey from 28pages.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing? Oh, I can't hear you.
Hey, Scott, how are you doing today?
Oh, there you are. Hey, I'm doing good. How are you?
You're very welcome. And it's 28pages.org.
.org. I said .com, huh? Sorry about that. Yeah, it was...
No problem.
I was pulling up the link, 28pages.org, and that's referring to 28 redacted pages of the original joint congressional committee investigation of the failures of the government departments leading up to the September 11th attack, correct?
That's exactly right. That report that they produced, you know, very authoritative, over 700 pages, and, you know, throughout it, you've got a name blacked out here, a place blacked out there, but then all of a sudden you come to this chapter and it's a complete screeching halt. You know, 28 full pages, the entire thing is just wiped out.
Mm-hmm. And now when it comes to credible leaks and information and statements made by congressmen and senators who've read it and know what it is, do you think there's much in there that we really don't know yet, or we pretty much know what's in there, we just want to see it for ourselves at this point?
I mean, I think we have a strong sense, and there's a press conference on Capitol Hill yesterday as Congressman Jones and Lynch, Republican and Democrat, were joined by Senator Bob Graham to reintroduce a resolution urging the president to declassify them. The vigor with which they talk about what is in these 20 pages and why it's so important that they be seen. You know, I don't know what's in them, but the way they talk, it seems pretty striking in that if nothing else, it may, I guess maybe seeing it right in front of you, or maybe the detail or the extent of what was indicated, you know, specifically about apparent ties, you know, to Saudi Arabia. It sounds like it could be actually very, very intriguing and unsettling and influential of our foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, so We know that from previous released FBI files that the FBI at least claimed in their documents that Prince Bandar's wife had sent a check, I believe, to Al-Bayoumi, the apparent Saudi asset in San Diego who was helping harbor the Flight 77 pilots?
That's right. There are financial links between Bandar's wife and money going out there. You've also got Bayoumi himself, you know, who just happened after he had a meeting at the L.A. consulate of Saudi Arabia with the Islamic affairs people, just happened, he says, to have met two of the 9/11 hijackers who had just arrived just a couple weeks, 10 days after the terrorist summit in Malaysia. He just happened to meet them and said, oh, I'm going to be welcoming to them because they're speaking Saudi accents, and happened to take them down to San Diego and pay their first month's rent and then continuing money to them. And Bayoumi is pretty much known to the United States as being a Saudi intelligence asset. He was working at a no-show kind of job at a Saudi company in San Diego, and his quote-unquote salary there mushroomed and ballooned coinciding with the arrival of these two. So it's pretty damning, the web of connections that we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Prince Bandar himself has demanded that the 28 pages be released because he says it'll clear his name from all this innuendo.
Yes, and Congressman Lynch and Senator Graham have been asked about that, and they pretty much dismiss it, not necessarily in their words, but as a bluff, it's kind of a calculated thing. They knew that at the time of, they were urging this release, during the Bush administration. I think they pretty much knew Bush was not going to release them, so they just used it as a PR angle to say, they want them out as much as you and I do, but I really don't think that's the case. And
yeah. Well, and we know from even Greg Palast's earliest reporting after September 11th that the FBI had been told back off the Saudis because everybody involved in paying protection money to Al-Qaeda to not attack Saudi Arabia were the same people who were business partners with the Republicans who were coming into power. And it was all very embarrassing. And so you should back off of all those kinds of investigations, which was right at the exact wrong time to be doing so. And, I believe it's Graham, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it Senator Graham who complained that when the story broke, a couple of years ago, about this house in Florida where some Saudi royalty were living and some 9/11 hijackers had been coming and going, that this was the first he'd heard of it. The FBI hadn't told him about this before. This was not in the investigation. This is a whole other leg of this thing that had been kept secret even from these 28 redacted pages. Am I right?
That's exactly correct, Scott. And if your listeners go to 28pages.org, they'll find some very interesting articles on that topic. But it's exactly right. It was an investigative media outlet in Florida called the Florida Bulldog, formerly the Broward Bulldog. Dan Christensen's an investigative reporter there. He was tipped off by a few other reporters that there had been a FBI investigation of him, of a 9/11 cell in Sarasota. He started to dig into it. And this is 10 years, mind you, after the Senate Intelligence Inquiry. And he thought, well, I'll check first with Bob Graham. And he was absolutely startled when he approached Bob Graham. And Bob Graham said, the FBI never told me anything about a cell in Sarasota. And then as they pursued it through Freedom of Information Act and so forth, first Christensen was told, we looked into it and there was absolutely nothing we found. He said, well, that sounds, could you let us see the documents, related to the investigation? They said, we don't have any documents to show you, which is, if you investigate something, you're going to have some kind of paper trail. And then as it went on and on, 35 very damning pages came out. And now a judge, as part of the FOIA lawsuit, and there's a good judge on this case because he's not really going for the FBI stonewalling. He's reviewing tens of thousands of pages now that the FBI has produced on this. But you're right, it was a wealthy Saudi family living just outside Sarasota really nice upscale neighborhood, who had 9/11 hijackers contact with them directly at their house. We've got, you know, the gate records and so forth, phone records.
And they had abruptly left the country right before or right after the attack?
They left about, I believe, 2 weeks, 10 days before, and in sudden fashion.
Right.
We're talking brand new, newly registered vehicles in the driveway, fresh groceries, clothing, just the safe door swinging open in the bedroom. I mean, absolute emergency, unplanned. We've got to get out of here instantly is what it really looked like.
Yeah.
So pretty interesting.
Yeah, and you know, it's also so interesting too. A couple more, and we're so short on time. I'm sorry, Brian, but
okay.
We have all the hubbub about the torture monger Bukowski. Alfreda Bukowski at the CIA, who is the red-haired lady in the movie Zero Dark Thirty and told this lie that torture led to Osama, etc. She's also the one who apparently called the shot that said the CIA should not tell the FBI about the Al-Qaeda guys in San Diego. And when confronted with some of this information by Ray Noaleski, I'm sorry, I know I'm saying his name wrong, but the guy that did Press for Truth and the Rich Blee podcasts 1 and 2, Richard Clark says the CIA must have been trying to recruit these guys up until it was way too late. That's the only reason that he could think of why George Tenet knew all about these guys and didn't tell him. I mean, this stuff is so huge. And that the Ray Noaleski and his partner there, especially the sequels to Press for Truth, that should have been just absolute blockbuster news all over TV, everywhere.
Right.
Richard Clark's statements there. There's so much here. And I'm sorry, I don't even know if I have a question. I thought I had one a second ago,
well,
but it floated away. So let me ask you something better, which is, tell me very quickly about the progress you've made, the successes you've made so far, and how people can help you actually get this done, Brian.
Yeah, we're up against some powerful forces between people protecting Bushes in Saudi Arabia and the intelligence community, as you just talked about, having its own motives. The main thrust is political pressure. You know, we can't trust all the mechanisms of government to do the right thing, so it's going to be a political pressure on the president to declassify this. And the principal thrust of that right now is House Resolution 14. And we want people to contact their congressmen and women, and we enable that at 28pages.org. We've got pre-written letters. You can just print one out and fire it away. We've got, you know, scripts for making a phone call.
And how many congressmen you got on your side already now?
It's 21 at the end of last session, and then we restart now with the new Congress.
Okay, that's great. 28pages.org, guys. Take part in this. Come on. 28pages.org. Thank you. That's Brian McGlinchey. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
See y'all Monday or Sunday morning. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott.